During the summers of my childhood in South Jersey, when the sun was bright and high, there were only a few ways to escape the heat. There was the ice cream man, but that was just a momentary fix. And of course, there was the log flume at Clementon Park, our rinky little budget amusement park, which was pure, unadulterated, chaotic bliss, but could be a bit pricey for all of us. But the one place I remember most fondly was at Sign Lake. Tucked in the Pine Barrens, it was a lake filled with dark, tea-colored water, with mushy patches and sharp sticks beneath your toes, which you couldn't even see. Going to Adson Lake was a treat for those of us who didn't have money for plane rides or rich relatives to send for us. At Adson, you didn't even pay per person to get in. You paid per car. So we'd pile in, drive the 20 minutes listening to WDAS, the local soul and R&B station on the radio, hand over a few bucks when we arrived, and the day was ours. Sandwiches and baggies, sour cream and onion chips, cheap soda from Acme in the cooler. You'd see your neighbors, your cousins, kids from school, and most of us waiting in that cool, ugly, amazing water until the sun went down were black. And it was beautiful. In some ways, looking back, I can't help but think we were escaping more than the summer sun. We were finding the freedom to just be. In a world where being black and free are not always congruent, black folks in America have always found ways of escaping the strictures of this country's invisible and sometimes geographic racial boundaries. And there are few more vivid illustrations of that escapism than our summer traditions. Some were sent back down south to visit relatives. Others took road trips along well-worn paths to places like Adson Lake. Still others created havens that would draw on more than just black tourists who are running from the heat of summer and the heat of racism. Black people have sought and built whole towns and resorts that became beacons of black self-sufficiency and independence, where families could swim and boat and fish and be their full selves in peace. Teachers and artists, businessmen and women, working and middle-class folks flocked to places with names like Idlewild in Michigan, Highland Beach in Maryland, Oak Bluffs on Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, and Bruce's Beach in California. These black Edens drew generations of upwardly mobile black people who were shut out of white America during much of the 20th century. Today, just a few of these communities remain predominantly black, if they remain at all. They've been done in by desegregation, the evolving whims of a younger generation of black families, and more recently, gentrification. But some of these havens have survived.
The tension was removed. It was friendship and fun and games and solidarity. We stayed strong, and we still are strong.
I'm Trymaine Lee, and this is Into America. Today, with summertime upon us, we explore the traditions and legacy of summering while black in one of the last and shrinking black beach communities in the United States, an historic enclave in Sag Harbor on Long Island.
It was unusual for African Americans to find a place near the water.
Wow.
Or on the water.
William Pickens III spent almost his entire life going to Sag Harbor in the summers, first as a kid, then taking his own family out there for the season. What age did you start going out there for the summers?
10. I was 10.
10 years old.
And I'm almost 85, so I came out here at a tender age.
When he retired, he decided to live out there full time.
So I've been here 20 years. I was the first one in my family to retire here.
I met Mr. Pickens back in 2011 when I wrote a story about Sag Harbor for the Huffington Post. So I called him back up to talk about the importance of this place, its history, and his experience growing up in the Black Hamptons.
I had an aunt who had a home here she built in 1908.
Wow.
And I came out in lieu of going to camp in the 40s, I came to Sag Harbor. I didn't like camp, too regimented. So I came out here where I could fish and swim and run and bike and all that stuff.
So what was that initial appeal? You have to imagine 1908, you know, America was a different place, but Black folks were finding their way out there. What was the appeal?
Well, it was bucolic, country setting on the water. So she liked it and heard about it and came out and bought a little house with outdoor plumbing, not inside plumbing. We had an outhouse.
That's old school, huh?
Yeah, that was old school. But that was how our family first came to Sag Harbor 113 years ago.
Wow. And so y'all were still traveling from New York, from the
city? Yeah, from our home in Brooklyn. We had a townhouse in Brooklyn. And if the whole family was coming out, my mother would prepare lunch, sandwiches, and put it on ice from the ice box. If you didn't have a refrigerator, you had an ice box.
Hmm.
And we would load the car. We had a Buick, and Dad would drive, and it was a long trip in those days. You didn't have all these super highways. It was a four-hour, five-hour trip, and there were only gas stations every, 40 or 50 miles.
Wow.
And then we'd get to Sag Harbor, and we'd unpack the car and go to our own. By then, we had our own home in 1950. So unloaded and began to enjoy the wonders of Sag Harbor as a family.
Wow.
It was country.
Yeah.
Far different than Brooklyn. You went from concrete to sand and dirt and noise to quiet. But there was an enormous difference in the quality of life. The space and the clean air and the stars at night. In Brooklyn, you had smoke coming out of chimneys. And you never saw the stars. But here, they were clarion clear. Mm. And you could see Betelgeuse, the Little Dipper and the Big Dipper. You couldn't see them in New York.
Yeah.
But you could see them out here in Sag Harbor. And at one point, I knew all the names of all of the stars.
Mm.
Well, that was years ago when my mind was a lot sharper. For me, it was a great change from Brooklyn. And I loved it.
How often would y'all go out there?
Well, I came out in the summers in those days. No one lived here year-round except the Shinnecock and Montaukett families, pretty much. But for African-American families, year-round existence wasn't possible then.
Mm.
So it was a summer retreat, Memorial Day to Labor Day.
Yeah.
And that 90-day period was when you had family and friends come out, and that's how we did Sag Harbor. And then one day in the 50s, some guy named Colin Powell showed up.
Hmm.
From the Bronx, and we became friends. And we both went into service later in our lives, and he stayed and did pretty well.
He did all right for himself. I think he did all right.
Cole did okay.
And what were some of the summer traditions that your family would take part in?
Well, we rode our bikes. We had BB guns. We swam a lot, hit the beach, played baseball. Remember, Jackie Robinson had just joined the Dodgers, so all the Black kids out here and the Indian kids, the Shinnecocks and the Mont, we all playing baseball, thinking we could be the next Jackie Robinson, you know.
That's amazing.
There were bicycle races and this kind of thing. It was very simple, nothing too elegant or strategic, but fun. And then there were some fishing trips. My father bought a boat, and he'd like to go fishing for porgies and this kind of thing. And adventure, hide and seek. The kids would play hide and seek and all the children's games that we brought out from Brooklyn and the Bronx, Johnny on the Pony and Ringolivio. We played those games out here. It was fun in the woodlands because you could hide better than you can in the tenements of Brooklyn. The kids had more freedom. You weren't monitored, 24/7. And you learned a lot about yourself and your friends. There was more free time, more your own time, and you learned how to do things and how to experiment. If you didn't feel that you do something in Brooklyn, you could try it out here. And it helped us all to grow into manhood.
You know, it sounds like, it was a means to escape the hubbub of the city and city life. But in many ways, escaping racism and the gaze of white folks, where Black people could come together and be who we are together. Is that accurate?
Well, it removed the racial tension that is omnipresent in America, where white resentment works its way into your daily living. Here, a community of people who knew each other, had gone to college together, had worked together, had lived together in Queens or Brooklyn or New Jersey or Connecticut. So we did not have the police looking at us with askance and saying, you know, we don't really trust you guys, you're newcomers. We're going to keep an eye on you. We didn't have that here. We did not have the daily tension of the white power structure looking at us over our shoulder, monitoring our behavior. Didn't have that. We were a sort of a closed society here, where our mores and folkways were ours. They weren't imposed on us. They were generated by us. Big difference.
Yeah.
Big difference.
Why were communities like these in Sag Harbor safe spaces for Black people?
Well, back then, the town, which was 99% white, there were workmen in town, the plumbers and the architects and the, you know, you name it, gas providers. And our relationship became interesting because they needed our money because the war had ended and this town was struggling financially. And Black folks injected a lot of cash into this society. So our relationship was fine, but there wasn't much social intercourse, though.
Yeah.
It was the African-American families all sort of knew each other. There were just 12 of us at one point, 12 families here in Sag Harbor Hills. But we all knew each other, including my grade school principal. He was here, much to my chagrin. I thought I'd left him in Brooklyn, but he bought a house right in front of ours.
What did it mean to look and see this community, this burgeoning community of hardworking, industrious, beautiful Black people?
Well, it was interesting because you had judges and lawyers and doctors and dentists, and you had bus drivers, you had taxi drivers. You know, we didn't have any differentiation among the professionals versus the non-professionals. We were friends and family. And your title did not matter. It did not matter. And our first house guest was Langston Hughes.
That's amazing.
The great writer and poet. He was my father's roommate in college. And he came here in 1952 and read some poems.
Was he just Langston, a family friend? He's just Langston, reading
poems. I called
him
Uncle Langston, you know. he and my mother were very tight because they'd met in, I say, 1925 when he was a student. And she encouraged him in poetry. She would write him and say, you should publish this. And he'd write back, and I have these letters. He would write back, oh, I'm not famous, you know. And but she would cajole him and encourage him. And then when he told my father that he'd met this attractive woman in Philadelphia, my dad sought her out and finally married her. So
Wait, hold on. Let's stop the story right here. So Langston Hughes was the matchmaker for your parents?
Yeah, Langston Hughes went back and told his roommate that there was this fox in Philadelphia.
Got to meet her.
And got to meet her. And Pop met her and he wanted to marry her, but his father said, you got to finish law school first before you marry. He said, I don't know if I can leave her out there available. I better marry her. So,
better hurry up.
So they made a deal. He married her in 1930 while he was still a freshman in law school. So
wow.
He wasn't going to waive the graduation in 1932. He said, that fox out there. Hello. So anyway, but Langston was instrumental in putting them together.
Mr. Pickens, when all this is going on, Colin Powell's a friend of yours, you got Uncle Langston. Did you realize then, even as a child, that there was something special about where y'all were?
I took it as sort of ordinary because they were my parents' friends and colleagues. They weren't celebrities, but we never thought that this was such a super special place that we were so different from our friends back in Brooklyn.
Wow. When did it start to grow?
Well, it grew in the 60s. It started growing in the late 60s. And it was during July of 1962. I had just spent 3 years in Japan. I came back as a first lieutenant in the Air Force and wasn't thinking about getting married. I was thinking about coming back and setting my bachelor pad.
Right.
And it was 1962 that I spotted some beautiful girl walking up the beach in an orange bathing suit.
You can still see the color. You can still see it now.
Yeah, I can see it. And she had shades on, and she was beautifully tanned. And I said to one of my old friends, a young lady who hadn't seen me, I said, "Who that?" And he said, "That's Pat Brannon." I said, "Where does she live?" "Oh, she's from way down there in Nineveh." I said, "Well, introduce me to her." He said, "Oh, no, you go introduce yourself, right?" So I did. And once I confronted her, she's walking along the water. I went to her, introduced myself, and said, "How about a movie date?" You know, and that was it. So it was a partnership that was formed right here at the water's edge in Sag Harbor. So I owe a lot to Sag Harbor.
I was going to say, it's amazing how much of your life is kind of intertwined and entangled with Sag Harbor. You met your wife there, your friends.
Brooklyn, that's right. Sag Harbor. And I'm sitting there, you know, drinking a beer, and I said, who that? And I found out who that was.
Yeah.
And I married her.
Wow.
And we were married for 51 years.
Wow.
So we'd be married 57 if she had lived.
You became an adult and married and had your kids out there. What are some of the memories you have of bringing your kids
out
there?
Well, it was wonderful because our firstborn was a daughter, Pam, and she had her first birthday party here, her second birthday party here. She's had a party almost because she was born June 1st. So we celebrate in Sag Harbor routinely her birthday. And my sons came out here when they were born. And have enjoyed growing up out here. This is a part of their life that they don't want to give up. It's central to their being.
After the break, Mr. Pickens talks about the origins of the Black community in Sag Harbor. And we also hear from his son, John. Stick with us. We're back with William Pickens. You know, stepping back a little bit to go further back in history, obviously through, as you mentioned, the 60s, the Black communities in Sag Harbor were growing, right? You all were out there a bunch. But what about Black folks in Sag Harbor, period? Like, how did we first get out there and when?
Because of the whaling industry. Whaling was the economic arm of Sag Harbor in the 1830s. You needed to have men who would be willing to go for a year and a half away from America to whale, go out to the Pacific. They had to go around South America. There was no Panama Canal. So when you signed on a ship here, a few Blacks from Africans, Cape Verde Islands, from Harlem, from Brooklyn, a token number, became shipmates on these whaling craft. And they would be gone for 18 months. But that was really the first African presence in Sag Harbor. So you're going back to the 19th century. But by 1900, John Hope, the great scholar from Georgia, his wife went from Savannah, Georgia to Sag Harbor by boat. She was going to live in New York, but she got off the boat in Sag Harbor and liked it so much that she rented a room and then built a house. That's how the middle-class Black folk and the university folk heard about Sag Harbor. John Hope, the great scholar. And then my aunt, who was a teacher, heard about it. They were friends. She was friendly with this woman, Miss Hope, because she had taught at Tuskegee, and gave her the idea, well, come on out, right? So it started very small. It wasn't until the 30s that more African Americans came to Sag Harbor. And there was a school teacher who taught at Brooklyn Technical High School. And he came out and built four or five little cottages for his friends, and he rented them out. And that started more volume of coming to Sag Harbor back in the 30s. The Depression was on, so folks weren't taking fancy vacations.
Right, right.
But Sag Harbor afforded you a fishing opportunity. You started coming out by train and boat to check it out. But you weren't buying property then. Property was not for sale. That didn't happen until after World War II.
Wow.
When all this land became available.
So Sag Harbor, as we understand it, is on Long Island, but kind of talk to us about the Black beach communities within Sag Harbor.
Well, there are three beachfront communities. Azure Rest, which was the first one, that was founded in 1947 by two sisters. And it all started very innocently after World War II. All this land was available, and the people who owned it needed money. Sag Harbor Hills then came along. The owners here, this family from Virginia, they owned all this property that we have here now. And he thought, okay, I'll do what they're doing in Azure Rest and find a lot of willing customers, if the price is right, who are African-American. So that's how this happened. And Nineveh was, the impulse of Nineveh came through my father-in-law, who helped sell the lots to all his friends. Nineveh Beach, give me $400 or $500 and we can get ourselves some property.
Wow.
And they did. The thing that made this different was that you could own the waterfront. You couldn't do that in Oak Bluffs or Idlewild, but here you could own the bayfront. You could actually own property that would guard against intrusions on the beach. That was the fundamental difference. And that's why the beachfront lots went really fast, because the men and women recognized that, well, here's a glorious opportunity. We had our own beach, and that was the big difference, beachfront ownership.
Have folks in the community been able to hold on to that sense? Has it changed at all?
Well, it's changed a little bit, but I think there's a determination now that the families who can stay here will stay here. Because to replace this is almost impossible. It was wonderfully accessible for us, but now it's accessible to everybody. And all we can do is guard against the encroachment by staying here and paying our bills, paying our taxes, improving our properties. That's the only way we're going to survive this.
You know, what percentage of your neighbors are Black now? Like, or I should say, what percentage of your neighbors are white now? Has the demographics of the place changed dramatically?
Well, it's changed in one community, one of the communities, it's 55-45 now white. Others, it's 70-30. So, well, that's about it. 70-30.
Yeah.
But one community has gone over that.
The stakes are that high, though. If you don't hold on to it, it'll be gone forever.
Oh, it'll be gone forever. Once it's gone, forget it.
Hmm.
To buy back, forget it. If you had a house for $100,000, and now it's going to cost you $3 million to buy it back.
Wow.
I mean, that's the economics of the day.
Yeah.
And that's a threat. That's a threat. There was no interest from the larger community until maybe 25 years ago. They would drive by and never turn off the highway to see what was going on over here.
Right.
This was a Black enclave. Maybe they thought it was dangerous, or maybe they thought it was a waste of time. But it wasn't until the mid-90s that the white population began to look at Sag Harbor as an investment opportunity. So it's about 25 years. But the first 50, hey, no problem.
You know, Mr. Pickens, I want to ask you this. Your family has been there for so long, and I wonder, when you reflect on it all, you know, what your hope is for your family's legacy in Sag Harbor.
Well, first of all, I want it to continue. I'd like my children, grandchildren, to continue to enjoy this place because it is so special and accessible. I do have some worries about the future. I feel attached to this place, and my children are attached to this place. And that attachment is so strong that I'm sure they will resist as long and as hard as they can at vacating this land. My hope is that my great-great-great-grandchildren will have a shot at this place. And I just have one grandchild, right?
Yeah. Oh, they got to get to work. John,
hello.
John, I get to work.
Hello.
Is he right there? Is John right there?
Yeah, Johnny's here.
Mr. Pickens' son, John, was sitting next to him, helping with the recording. I met John on the beach in Sag Harbor 10 years ago. He's the one who hooked me up with his dad, so I got him in on the conversation.
What's up, Tremaine?
What's up, brother? How you feeling, man?
Hanging in there.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you, man, obviously, you know, talking to your father about the legacy of your family out there, is it pressure on you and your family?
It's all the pressure. I don't have any kids. I don't have a wife. Like, this man made miracles out here, literally. Found his wife and made a life and still had Brooklyn, still had Queens, still had Harlem in existence. Yeah. And this. So now that we're here, we're just trying to still show that it's alive and a living place. It's not a dying place. You don't come here to die. You come here to live. You come here to see your friends. You come here to run outside. You come here to take your shoes off. You come here to let your dogs run. You don't come to hide. You come here to thrive.
When you think about, you know, your generation, the next generation, are you concerned that, you know, folks will sell off and folks will look for the money and not be able to hold on to it? Is there a real concern?
You have some like that. And then, but then you have other generations where their families are working hard to keep this. See, it's different for us because it didn't cost us. Mm-hmm. This was already given to us. We just had to maintain it. And that's a cost in itself. But for us, it's maintaining our own piece of life and our own piece of liberty and our own piece of justice. And this is where we found it. And this is where we've carved it out for everyone else. So you don't have to come in and fight to earn these things because the respect is already understood. The thing about these keys, they don't change if you don't change them. The locks stay the same. I still have the key that my grandma had to the door because it's the same key and the same lock.
Wow, yeah. So how has growing up out there changed you?
Well, it's changed me in that it's just given me a well-rounded experience. I mean, it might be something more of a privilege, but it's an experience. It's like being able to come out and see your neighbors and know your neighbors, but have your neighbors know and see you.
Yeah.
They have to see you out on that water enjoying it. They have to see you driving down the beach to know that you're here enjoying the all rights and privileges.
Mm-hmm.
You're not excluded from anything.
Mm-hmm.
The door is open and the love is real. And this is God's country. We are still in God's country. Without freedom, there is no joy. And we have found joy and freedom.
Mr. Pickens, what's it like when you hear your son, John, describe his experience and how much it's meant to him? What does it mean when you hear him speak about this community that you helped kind of nurture and build?
Well, it means that it worked. It means that the time and effort we put in to establish this as a viable community over the last seven decades, that feeling has emerged in our children and grandchildren, that, boy, we are lucky. We're pretty lucky to have this in our lives, and we have to figure out a way to preserve it and nurture it. So when I hear my son John extol the virtues of this place, I smile.
William Pickens III lives in Sag Harbor, New York. And we always love hearing from our listeners. So don't forget, you can tweet me at Tremaine Lee. That's at Tremaine Lee, my full name, or write to us at IntoAmerica@NBCUNI.com. That was IntoAmerica@NBC and the letters UNI.com. Into America is produced by Isabel Angel, Allison Bailey, Bryson Barnes, Aaron Dalton, Max Jacobs, and Daisha Turner. Original music is by Hannes Brown. Our executive producer is Ellen Frankman. I'm Tremaine Lee. We'll catch you next Thursday.